Welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. This is your host, Ishai Breslauer. Here we meet every Monday to talk commercial real estate and prop tech. We will dive deep into the different asset classes, discuss the market, talk about the new and exciting technologies, meet key people in the industry, and get some inspiration. Let's begin. Hey guys, before we start, I just want to point out the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. It's a free download. Go to the text side and you will find it. It has absolutely great information, completely free, how to become a landlord, how to determine the value of a property, or creative financing for commercial real estate. All of it is completely free. Go download it. Also, I want to point out my CRE crash course. It's a 2-week must-have program with a must-have skills for commercial real estate, like investment strategies, the must-have financial terms, how a deal is done. Go take a look at it, go to the text side and click on the link. And now let's continue with our program. Hey guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. We try to bring you as much business and commercial real estate and prop tech. And today with us, the voice from Canada, from the North, you guys, not only from the North, from the Northwest, you guys will hear all about it. Benny Manasherov, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Shai. Thank you.
My pleasure. You know what? Before we start digging into your story, if you could give everybody a 2-minute elevator pitch of what you do, what you're about, and so on.
I appreciate that. So my spiel, In a short, is the fact that I'm a strategic advisor and an investment banker. And I pretty much went wrong. I'm not under any bank. I might be considered to be a loose fragment. And I work with between sophisticated investors. I move deal flow. I dial for dollars most of the time. And that's my 30 second, but if I'm allowed to add another, a little hump on it, my business is very diverse, starting from real estate, which is a perfect hedge against everything because everything happens above and under the real estate. I work within the technology sectors and I do business development to entrepreneurs that believe that the true meaning of money is to create job opportunities and make it accessible for other people.
I love it. Beautiful. And it sounds like you're pretty well established within few asset classes and few industries. And I can't wait to hear about it. Everything that you got. You know what? Let's go back in time a little bit because right before the show, full disclosure, everyone, we spoke Hebrew, and
yes.
So it means that Benny goes back. Benny, tell us about yourself, how you got to Canada, how you got to this business. How did you start?
So I started a long time ago. Basically, I was a BA student in Paris Academic College. And I got a chance to do some pre-sale in a capital market firm in Israel called Migdal Capital Markets. At that time, Migdal Capital Market used to be owned by Generali. And of course, in Israel, it used to be controlled by the biggest entity at that time, the biggest insurance group called Migdal Group. After that, 2008, Shlomo Eliyahu bought out from Generali Migdal and lost a lot of money in the process, by the way. He bought it half price and then he lost about 50% of value. But of course, with time, he's recuperating and he made most of his money back. In Migdal Capital Markets, I started as a pre-sale. They noticed that I have this nick. They noticed me pretty fast. Altogether, I've done various jobs through the holding company, including Migdal, where I did pre-sale retail, and then I did pre-sale for something we used to call an institutional department. And after that, they allowed me to do sale and pre-sale for the underwriting and investment banking team. And side along that, there was something going on in the firm, and they asked me to take over a little college that they started called the Migdal Academia le Finanzim shel Migdal Shukion Academic Fin. So we used to sell courses, and And we started when I came there, we had about 360 students. And the only reason why they used to come to us is because they wanted to get a job. And when I finished my project, we had about closer to 1,400 students. We had five locations countrywide. So I was an entrepreneur, and everybody allowed me to be, in Hebrew, we call it a sanjo. I did everything they allowed me to do. And I learned a lot. Especially I learned how processing works in a bigger organization. Then I went to Grand Thornton, Grand Thornton Israel, to be precise. And one of the managing partners showed me. He saw me for what I am. His name is Mickey Blumenthal, and he gave me a chance. He took a flyer on me, and I stayed there for about 2.5 years. Doing strategic advisory for the firm. What I used to do basically is to get bulk hours for the whole firm and act as an individual department. Like I used to sell the hours as I fit to my prospects. So that's it's a lot of power, but it pushes you to do investment banking big time. Of course, I didn't do anything by myself. I always assembled the team. I learned how to create partnerships. I was wet around my ears. I was really a kid when I started. But the people in Grand Thornton were really gracious, really well-established, really smart, and really they told me what not to do most of the time. And I have this chutzpah. So if you put me in the right direction, I create the database, I start selling. I mean, that's all I know, right? And then I started recognizing all the stuff that I don't know, and learned how to buy and sell businesses. After that, I did a couple of other things. Long story short, I decided to go to a sabbatical. I went to travel. The plan was to do a little bit more than what I did, but I met my wife here. I fell in love, and I stayed in Canada, and now I'm a Canadian citizen, so the story is over.
Tell me something, what a story. Tell me something, just to keep the chronological order, you know, intact, when you started, when did you finish your degree, and when did you go to Migdal? When was that, you know, approximately?
When I started my degree, I started working in Migdal Shukion.
And when was that?
Closer to 2008.
Oh, wow. 2008.
Yeah, when it crashed.
When it crashed. What a timing. And then you were there for a few years, and then you went and you did investment banking in Grant Thornton, Israel, you said. And then finally, you got to Canada. When was that, when you got to Canada, to your area?
First time I came to Canada was 2006, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe 16?
16, probably, right?
Yeah. I'm here for about 7 years now.
Wow. So I'm dying to hear this story. I know it's not related to business, but I'm so curious about it.
It's all around business. I mean, I my life is defined by business. Most people, when they talk to you, they tell me that it's business, it's not personal. I don't know what that means. Like, I see everything being personal. I do business only with people that I trust, only people that I love. And so it defines my day to day, the fact that everything is around business for me.
Yeah.
And everything is personal for me too. So yes, it is around business.
It's amazing.
Exactly.
When you got to Canada, first of all, your trip, you said you had this plan to go for a trip. I'm assuming it was much wider, like you said. But when you got to that area, it's west, meaning a lot of people will say, how'd you get there? You know, it's like, tell us where you are and how you got there and where did you meet your wife? And what circumstance? How did that happen?
So my wife, I think like any man, I mean, I don't know how to romanticize something which is romantic anyway.
Yeah, it's not a like,
like any man, I saw my wife and I thought she looked nice. I mean, that's all I thought in the beginning. And then I met her in Vancouver. So it's natural when you're in Israeli and you travel, you just hit a mall and you meet Israelis in any mall, they're walking there. So I was standing next to a kiosk with somebody that I met, talking to him. And I know that my wife, she's a half native, which is Indian, half Scandinavian. So she's tall. She has this long hair with deep blue eyes. She looks very Ashkenazi, but she has something native about her. So she's an anomaly. She looks special. I liked her. So, you know, I don't know any other way to do it. I just went and I said, hey, nice to meet you. Can I buy you dinner? And she said, yeah, you can buy me dinner. We started talking on the phone. We met after about 2 weeks after talking. And after we dated a couple of times, she had this thing happening in her family. Her grandmother passed away and then her dad passed away. And, you know, I really liked her. She said, I'm going to Prince George. And me being a tourist, I said, you know, why not? And I like the person. She's feeling pain. I wanted to support her. It wasn't anything serious at that point. I was just being a human being. And when I saw her in a natural environment with her family, just got me to a situation where I fell in love.
What a story. Going back to business, and you mentioned capital markets, and that's very, very interesting. Capital markets is a very wide area. There are a lot of asset classes, lot of things to do. What was the thing that you started with? Which part of capital? Was it M&A? Was it commercial real estate? Which part was the first part where you got introduced to and the first few deals you started to get your feet wet in?
So I pretty much know after, let's say, 15 years of working the private equity and creating deal flow for underwriters and being institutional, uninstitutionalized macher, that you cannot avoid real estate, even if you really try to. Now, commercial real estate is a big segment that has a lot of disciplines in it, but we simplify stuff. When I say we, I mean usually the good people. I mean, people that want to make you feel you're not okay, they try to complicate everything, but they don't really usually do business. There's only three ways where you can raise capital. It doesn't matter what kind of deal. It doesn't matter, it doesn't matter what the underwriter does for you. So underwriter is a multidisciplinary kind of a job, especially in capital markets. They can give you money for shares, meaning they can give you equity, they can buy equity or sell equity, and then they can allow you to borrow money against, of course, underlying assets, a loan. And then there's one specific place where both of those situations, they collide, they meet, we call it convertible debt. And around that, there's a lot of different structures that allow you to mainly leverage, right? Within the money, outside of the money, limited partnership, joint ventures, agreeing to do something, borrowing something. seller financing, etc., etc., that allows you to borrow the money or to do those three different variations in a lot of ways. So there's a lot of combinations you can create to raise capital. But we have no doubt that after, well, over 100 years in the US markets, which is by far the most advanced credit market, Wall Street and Main Street, the most advanced credit markets on the planet, there's no other way to do it. There's only other ways to look at it. Now, real estate is an amazing segment that allows you to get huge amount of leverage and then to locate discounted deals and to buy options that doesn't cost you any money as an entrepreneur, which is amazing for somebody that wants to create value and wants to play this investment game.
Right.
So yeah, I got my feet wet in real estate. First deal was 9 strip malls in Germany. They needed 36 million euros. It was a group. And I raised the capital as a joint venture between me and an ex-underwriter in Israel. He took the company, marketed the company between and a publicly traded entity from Israel, invested the 36 million. We did it. It was a very simple way of marketing it. We created a strategy that says, doesn't matter what the deal says, you get 1.25 multiplier, which is a great multiplier to invest in. And it doesn't require, like you do due diligence, but it doesn't require from the investor to rely on the investments because they see equity, they see the multiplier, so they understand exactly what's going on because they understand the numbers by looking at the multiplier. So that was my first thing.
Okay, so what I understand from you, and that's, I think it's very interesting, that you look at deals, and correct me if I'm wrong, when you look at deals, what you care mostly is the financial structure. Is where am I coming in, Benny, in the finance world of the deal, whether I come in from the equity stand, pref equity, that way, this way, JV, LP, no matter, but that's how you see it. That's how you see a deal from a financial perspective. What am I asking? Some people look at a deal and they love the deal. And then they start dealing with, okay, what am I going to do with finance? How am I going to do that? How am I going to deal with the finance? But you come from perspective of, okay, there's a deal. I'm starting to see, okay, what do you need? How do we go? How do we attack it financially? And where's the benefit from the investment perspective of the deal? Am I correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trained to think financially and structurally, but I must say that before I would look at the deal at all, most likely that my first question would be very much related to the tax planning behind the deal.
Oh, wow.
I mean, any commercial deal, if you're planning to close, there'll be an asterisk somewhere on the contract. Even it will be on the memorandum of understanding or the letter of intent that any deal can be approved only if it clears with the tax plan. I mean, if the tax planning doesn't know how to observe the deal, the money needs to move somewhere, it needs to hit accounts, and right, it needs to activate whatever you're trying to scheme, then the deal is it's defaulted. Because tax is something that sometimes only by avoiding the taxation, you make the deal feasible. Because taxation affects dramatically on any deal, and real estate, to be precise, we're talking about real estate. Real estate is one of those vessels that allows you to use real estate, commercial real estate, as a tax deferral.
Right, 1031.
It's one of those. So exchange is one of them, but also the depreciation in relationship with cash flow, and there's a lot of aspects to it.
So you know, I want to ask you one second. Sorry, I'm stopping you. I just want to focus.
No, it's okay.
It's really interesting. So
thank you.
When you have a situation, you have a deal coming up, and you want to know, first of all, from a taxation perspective, what's going on there? What would be your question? I have a deal. What are you going to ask me? What type of strategy are you looking for?
So strategies are, it's just something that you decide to gather as an idea when you're selling something.
Right.
But you are a buyer. You are a buyer, right? You're trying to finance something. You want to buy it.
Yes.
So it's a big question. I respect that. So kudos to you. But I would look at fundamentals. First of all, I'm guessing that we have some kind of a relationship. I mean, we have trust.
Right.
I mean, without trust, nothing moves.
For sure.
Without trust, I want to answer the phone, but without trust, I have difficulty because I don't know after I answer the phone what I'm facing with, especially in real estate. There's a lot of play around that. Creating trust and having it has a big meaning. I mean, that's the meaning of a holding company today. So if I'm looking at the deal on the fundamentals, I would say, so what's the underlying asset? What's the cash flow? And show me 1, 2, 3 exit strategies to allow me to start thinking and grinding, thinking and imagining the way the deal looks. And then I would say, why is the seller selling this? And why are we buying this? And I would like to know not just what's the strategy to sell it or how you will get LPs into the deal, for example. I would like to know the motivation. And that usually explains to me, if you're the entrepreneur, what your motivation usually, what makes you buy deals and not just deal flow, because deal flow is not as good as what people think it is. I mean, there's a reason why this bride is outside. Yeah. So there's a reason why most of the sophisticated or most of the professional investors don't work with brokers. I mean, the reason is really simple. Brokers, they're the same as listing agents. They know how to take the deal and list it. They can hold the deal. And then they're trying to sell the deal just for the commission. I mean, it's okay to make the commission, but you cannot sell the deal just for the commission, because if you go into an investor, then you need to show him the discount. I mean, he's an investor. There's a reason. I mean, there's a premium for being an investor. So he needs to have a discount. You need to understand his limited partners and what their motivation, and then the GP's motivation. I mean, what makes him tick? What kind of deals he likes? So every investor has his own ecosystem that you need to work with. And when you're marketing it, it's just like you're coming out of a massive bureaucracy and stepping into another bureaucracy. And you're sharing this information. You have to do it very gently. You still need to sell, but you don't want to oversell, because then you need to keep yourself relevant in a deal, especially if you're the middleman and you don't have any equity or you don't have any kind of formal relationship with the group, which happens sometimes, especially on the bigger deals, by the way. So just to get back to your original question, I would ask, usually what motivates me to understand is who's buying the deal. Even if I'm the GP, if I'm the investor, still I need an exit strategy. I mean, I'm not buying it just to buy it. That doesn't make sense.
Right.
And if I'm executing, if I'm buying for myself, if I'm the GP and I have my own LPs, then very basically I look at the underlying asset, the equity, I look at the cash flow. And I'm not asking a lot of questions. I'm taking the deal to my bank, and I'm asking my bank if they see that I have enough equity, and then what will be the cost of the interest. I see if the deal can pay the interest, and if I have some, you know, wiggle room.
Yeah.
Because I have to stress check any deal, and I need to check it. Of course, usually if the bank allows it, the bank has, well, the stress on the equity with the bank is on first mortgage is about 50%. On second mortgage, you get extra 30%. So there's some wiggling room, but we are another hand, Yadno Sefetalaiska.
Right.
That hand needs to get paid as well. So we have a structure, and then we have to consume, we have to obey to the banking. We have to pay, we want to pay. Nobody wants to take a loan and not to be able to pay the loan back. And this is how I look at it. I simplify everything. And then I try to see, can I buy the deal? And how much time do I really have to hold the deal before I can, even if I leave it on my books, before I'm out of the deal? I mean, if I manage to transfer the deal to one of my LPs, or I sold it completely, still, do I still get some equity inside? So do I get something, you know, some taste just by going through the deal? But really, like from my experience, I'm like, I don't know if you ever seen you've seen A Pretty Woman.
Yeah, I've seen years ago.
I'm a sure thing. I mean, I look at deals and not in a harsh way. I want to do more deals all the time. I have the appetite. I say to my clients, I have so much time because I live in Prince George. I have no distractions. I don't like to sleep, and I wake up about 4 o'clock in the morning. And when I wake up, I start by meditating, preparing myself to the day, and I'm waiting for that phone call. I'm always waiting. I'm talking to my entrepreneurs, they're working. I mean, it's a global thing. I have a guy working in, he lives in Vienna, he works in Europe, he's looking at deals in France. We don't work with brokers at all. We work directly with companies such as CBRE or other real estate advisory firms.
Yeah.
And again, the underlying assumption is really, I'm a broker in a lot of deals. I mean, people might call me a broker, but I'm a professional investor. When I look at brokers, the problem is the fact that they don't know how to do the deal. And it's a problem. It's a big problem. I mean, I talk with a publicly traded company that buys and sells hotels. They want to hold the hotels. They have money because they're publicly traded in Canada. It's an Israeli group. So we speak Hebrew. It's a free exchange of information. I say, I have a hotel. They say, Benny, we can come with you, but we're just telling you that if it doesn't come through CBRE, the paperwork doesn't show up, it takes our audit, makes it expensive, and we're not sure that we can put you in the place that you want to be. They know that I want to close it. I don't care about just talking. So it's a straight up conversation, which usually people don't get, because if you're an outsider, it's hard to get from the people that make the decisions the answers. The answer can be no, of course. I mean, not everybody will tell you yes, but when we're on the process, and I'm trying to save this time, which equals to a lot of money to professional investors, especially to the GPs. They are hustling and working hard to locate these special deals and to find the special stuff. It's good for us to know that no means no and yes means yes. And if it means yes, we want to do business and we want to close, So we are always ready. We have the information ready to processing by the right people inside of these organizations that are looking at deals. Yeah. Whew, I have to breathe.
Well, you have to breathe. And I'll tell you, it's very interesting listening to you on so many levels. And I think
Thank
that
you.
Canadian group, we both, I also know who you're talking about, is very interesting. The one thing that I am very, very curious about is, because you're in so many places, seems like you are, you know, all over the place in terms of deals, and you have connections really worldwide. And it seems to me, meaning what I want to ask is, meaning for so many deals, there has to be an investor's base. Where is your investor base? Is it Canada? Is it Israel? Is it the U.S.? Is it different parts of the U.S.? Is it all together? Is it, meaning, what is your strategy in terms of investment management, in terms of getting the marketing into the investors and getting them?
I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. So starting with any deal, I want to look. I love looking at deals. I think everything is good. I'm the worst analyst on this planet. I want to look at everything all the time. But that's true. I mean, you need an investment base. The investment base is not what usually people think. I mean, if somebody comes to me and the first phone call, they say, I want private investors, I'm not going to answer again to that call. I mean, it's just a waste of time. That means that they shopped around with the deal.
Yeah.
And they're looking for firing. I mean, that's what that means to me. They're just looking for people that don't know how to evaluate the deal. So I'm not playing that game. My investment base is very simple. Most of my day-to-day, whatever I'm eating with is not big deals. Strategy deals are okay, but I don't have the capacity to hold strategy. I cannot take five deals over $100 million. I mean, I will kill myself.
Yeah.
It's impossible. So you my basic deals... Yeah, it's too heavy. I'm not equipped. I don't have that kind of... Like, I have my brain trust. The people that I exchange time with, that's on a free basis. I mean, we exchange time. We support each other. Two of them are ex-underwriters from Israel. One of them is, I think, the best CFO that I ever met. Used to be the CFO of the most liquid group that I ever seen in Israel. I mean, billions of dollars. And is the smartest CFO that I ever met. And I know people, and like I know CPAs, I mean, but he's amazing. And he's also working as an LP in an infrastructure fund. So, and that's how my kitchen looks. Coming out of my kitchen, I have about five portfolio managers that have their own Nostro accounts. When I say Nostro account, for the people that don't know the capital market terms, I mean, a Nostro account is just an account and you have the permission to buy when it's going up or going down. So it's a black box. It basically says that you can put your money for whatever. But if you're doing private equity deals, it means that you have to observe the audit. So my as an investor, when I engage my portfolio managers, and I usually engage them on a private equity basis, I take cash from them and I inject it into companies. I observe the audit. So I hire, in Canada's case, MMP, which is the second largest accounting firm in Canada right now, because they did mergers and acquisitions. They bought out PwC in Canada. So I will hire MNP, and they will come and look at the deal, and we'll create the paperwork to complement the money extraction from his pool and injecting it into the company. So it's that simple. I don't have to be smart for this purpose. I need to have a little bit of money. And I cannot look at deals that are less than $2 million, $3 million because, well, it costs me the same amount of money to do the audit for any deal. So why would I spend the money that I have for something that doesn't get me a return? And the deals that I want to do are usually deals where I can take companies public, meaning it's kind of a RTO kind of a deal. It means that real estate is out of the question because for real estate, I need to do a lot more money to get the same amount of returns. So I would talk to people that have, let's say, holding companies or venture capital funds, and they have companies that are ripened, that are ready for public markets. And Canada is great for VCs because this is not the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, Canadian capital.
For sure.
Yes, it's smaller. Venture cap works here. I mean, cannabis was a big thing in Canada. Now they have other markets coming up. But there's a lot of shares in the Canadian market and CPCs that are looking for energy sector exploration and investments and stuff like that. So I can give you an example for right now. I'm under contract. So I'm not going to be specific, but I'm under contract with a holding company. It's an ESG alternative energy holding company with minority holdings with an Israeli accelerator. It's a chief scientist accelerator, meaning $36 million. They get it in premium prices. And then when they lend out the money to startups, they give 20% and the chief scientist gives 80% for specific companies. So they have a minority holding in that. They won the bid, and then they have minority holdings in several other companies, including two publicly traded companies in Israel. So very sexy, ESG. So this is how I look at it. Now, I market the companies this way. I will never say something that I don't mean. It's very sexy. It's good. It needs money, and money is looking for those deals. So they approached me. They found me through contacts that I have, meaning lawyers mainly. So specific lawyers from specific firms that know me and trust me, they give people my name. And I happily talk to those people because I assume that if they're talking to those lawyers, they're serious and they're not trying to scam anybody. Then I do my own due diligence. And the market is the best way to do any due diligence. So my plan, when I take a company, I didn't talk valuations. So pre-money valuation, $120 million for the holding company, for the global general partner.
Uh-huh.
And we're looking to raise between $20 to $25 million. We're willing to sell about top 16% from the holding company. There's a premium, but the company is fairly valuated because there's inside of the company, there's a unicorn hiding. So there's a reason why it's stacked exactly that way. And of course, the government money is very nice. It's very sexy. Like if I wanted to do this deal tomorrow, my best way to do the deal, I mean, my dream, sorry, not my best way of doing the deal. Optimal scenario is taking a loan from BDC Canada, Business Development Canada, which is Business Development is a bank, works, it's a crown corporation in Canada.
And they give it
they have globally? A bank.
They give the loans.
Sorry?
They give the loans globally?
No, but that means that we just need to open up a Canadian company. I am Canadian.
Got it.
Yeah. So the best scenario for me would be to take a loan for the money to put in from one of my LPs, to put in, let's say, 20% of the $25 million, to take the loan for 6%, lend the company the money, but lend it only for the stuff that I want to control the flow of capital.
Right.
So that's how you exercise as an investor. That's how you exercise your option to invest. But if not, second option will be a SPAC, some kind of a, not a CPC, but some kind of a holding company or to take them public to Canadian markets, capital markets, to bring in a decent underwriter, which I know, they have the right team. I mean, their team is top notch. I mean, their pitch is great. I will not be embarrassed sitting in a table like that. So taking them to an underwriter and raising capital for this company. I mean, I'm guessing there's going to be some negotiation, maybe 120 for this market will be too much, but it will not go less than 110 million US. Even if it's taken, yeah. So then I look at deals like those two, and I look at them. Most people think that I'm a middleman, but it's not a middleman.
So I can define it because I'm listening to it and enjoying every word. And I see you as a strategist. You really come and attacking the deal from the right direction and seeing it for what it is and understanding what type of capital, where do you attack it? How do you take it? What type of valuation is correct, et cetera, et cetera. And I love the way you think. It's beautiful. I want to shift gears for a second. I want to shift gears for a second before we end the show. I want to ask you, the world is going upside down a little bit today, to say the least.
Perfect time.
Interest rates, inflation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
Give us, a couple of minutes of your perspective and what's going on.
So first of all, it's Warren Buffett said that the best time is when the blood is in the streets.
Yeah.
So a rising interest rate, I don't think that rising interest rate changes the parameter of any deal. I mean, the market knows how to work with 11% interest rate and grow. So yes, there will be a reevaluating. People will have to reevaluate deals, stress check the deals. But something very simple is going to happen in the market. I mean, I don't assume I'm part of the movement. I mean, I'm very active. So instead of what we had, especially in the financial sector, we had an expansion of the private equity sector. The private equity sector, which is a bunch of middlemen hiding under an umbrella, calling themselves a private equity, they have a lot of ways raising capital. Some of them can be search funds, which are basically a CEO that lost his job in a big company and is looking for an opportunity. He buys an option and then he raises capital from an insurance group. Some other ones, they already have money and they're just looking for deals. And some of them are just equity. Other ones are mezzanine. But the only thing that's really going to happen in this market will be a massive consolidation. So the smaller, the fragmented private equity firms will just get absorbed by the bigger entities. And the smarter entrepreneurs, the activists, the financial activist investors, will form a merger and acquisition firms. And they will just buy up this cash.
They'll swallow them.
They will just buy a piles of cash and they will just repackage. Because what do we have? What do we have in the market? We have this. People are buying equities for the last 10 years and they think they're geniuses because they're getting money for free from the LPs, meaning the insurance groups, and then for the working capital, I mean, when they actually trade, they're getting the money for free too. So any money they make goes from the from the top line to the bottom line. They pay extreme. They don't buy three times EBITDA. They buy 9 times EBITDA because they already have the cash. So they're being very competitive in the market. Now they're going to pay for it. And the way they're going to pay for it, they're going to just give other people the control for the GP. I mean, right now,
yeah,
if I'm just looking,
the GP position.
Yeah, they're gonna lose the GP position. If I'm looking not on small fragmented private equity firms, I'm looking at REITs on the New York Stock Exchange. I mean, the REITs are traded 25% pre-COVID valuation. So basically, technically speaking, you can buy the REIT for free. You can make it private just by getting a loan from the bank. Now you look at the NAV, you look at the net values, and it's 15%, 12% discount on the NAV, which is mind-blowing. I mean, a REIT, it's a cash flow deal. REIT pays on the average. I mean, I'm just talking generally. It pays 6% dividend to the holder. It pays 6% dividend, no problem. And it still pays, well, massive salaries, and it's publicly traded. If you're making it private, you're unshelling, you're de-structuring this massive structure, and you get the underlying business. You don't have to go to the properties. I mean, you get the underlying business, it's already light. It doesn't have to do all... He doesn't have to carry all the external directors, extra directors that you hire, a massive team. He doesn't need to pay all the fees for the accountants and the lawyers for being publicly traded. So you're making, if you buy something for $1 billion, right now that means that you're making on paper on day one, $100 million, easy. And then you're saving from your cost, from your burn rate, at least $15 million a year, just by making it. So, and the private market right now is paying a premium for being private.
Right.
It pays about 12% premium. So if you're just doing some kind of calculation, you want to be crazy for a second, you're buying it in 12 to 15% discount, and you're getting... For appraised value, you're getting about 15% premium. That's a huge, huge gap. I mean, there is no better way to sell investment than this. I mean, we're all greedy. This is. It's a historical time. I mean, I've been working only 15 years in capital markets.
Which sector is that where you see those opportunities? Which sector you would point out that's where you find the opportunities? Because it's clearly not commercial real estate right now.
I have to say that when I speak about stuff like that, I mean, I get excited about everything. So I'm a sure thing. But I have to quote Warren Buffett, which makes a lot of sense. And when I speak to my entrepreneurs, I have this mantra about the deal. Real estate is one thing because there's a different way of looking at real estate, but an operational company, you buy it when it's 3x EBITDA. And if it's publicly traded, 3x EBITDA, and then you just compare it to the market cap just to get the right price for the share. I mean, right. That's it. You don't have to go to sectors. You can just target individual companies. And you don't have to be a genius. I mean, the market went down 30%.
Right. This is the best time. Benny, yes. I got to listen. I can, it's so interesting. I can listen to you until tomorrow. It's unbelievable. You have so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. I talk a lot.
Knowledge, so much input about different types of aspects in the capital market. I simply love it. But I want to tell everybody, you guys probably can see the links above and below, how to contact Benny. Benny, if you could tell everybody how they can find you.
Well, I'm on LinkedIn. My name is Benny Manasherov. And if somebody needs an advice, my phone number is 250-552-4855, +1 for Canada.
You guys got the number. You can call him up. You can contact him through LinkedIn. You can call him up. And Benny's a brilliant guy. He has tons of experience, wealth of experience in capital markets, in different sectors, commercial real estate, to M&A, different financial aspects. And he's definitely going to be on my book that if I have something interesting, I would love to call him.
I appreciate that.
I want to keep in touch with. I hope you guys enjoyed it and learned tons. And Benny, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your time. And I hope it was informing and fun. Like I want it to be.
It was very fun. Stick around. And you guys, I'm going to see you in the next show. Take care.
Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.